My fellow Americans and all those listening overseas, welcome back to Visiting the Presidents. I'm your host, Joe Fakash, and today we are on the road to Richmond, Virginia, and the second burial place of James Monroe, fifth president of the United States. Before I go too far, I want to remind you to be checking out visitingthepresidents.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to associated readings for the presidential sites, my photos from various trips, recommended readings, and so much more. You can also follow along on the social media profiles at Visiting the Presidents on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where I provide additional content throughout the week. Liking and commenting helps to raise the profile, and I appreciate any of you who've written a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You'll also find a link to help support Visiting the Presidents through PayPal. Your support helps to fund the production, editing, and hosting of Visiting the Presidents episodes and the website, as well as future trips, books, and more. All support is greatly appreciated. At the top of the Mount Rushmore of giving is Sam and Tom Fakash, Nancy and Terry Workamp, Debbie and Dennis Fakash, Harvey and Casey Hyman, Connie and Adam Luck, Brittany and Keith Mellon, Stephanie Gaskill, and Andrew Alexander. Also, Jim and Catherine Hyman, Gail Rittenhouse, Sean and Liz Jones, Stephen Gilroy, Kurt Dion, Alexis Mira, April McKenzie, Matt and Megan Hoekstetler, Caitlin Cahillan, Jim and Laurel Brayler, Eric Engartner, Patricia Argentina, Kara Steiner, Jamie and Ted Wilson, Candy and Ben Phelps, Lana Demers and Craig Hunter, Kenneth Robinson, Thomas Kalina, Kristen and Steve Wendell, and Alex Seiker. Thank you all so much. I want to recommend that you go back to listen to the previous season's episode on each president. For James Monroe, check out season one, and in season two, James Monroe and Highland. Now, we're going to pick up the action right where we had left off with that season two episode, where we also talked about his home in Oak Hill and where he is afterwards and will eventually die in New York City. Now, where we had left off, James Monroe was easily reelected to his second term in 1820, only one vote from being unanimously reelected. His second term, usually highlighted as the era of good feelings after the tumult of the previous decade, also belied the growing sectional tension over slavery's expansion, the fallout of Congress's contentious Missouri Compromise. President Monroe followed the model of letting Congress run legislative debates, but the fallout of the Missouri Compromise, one of the most decisive statements on the expansion of slavery to date, completely pleased no one and kicked the ball down the road for further conflicts. President Monroe did not engage his cabinet on the topic, but did play a role behind the scenes, and he made clear that he would veto any measure that would try to impose restrictions on Missouri being admitted. James Monroe's legacy as president was solidified with the Monroe Doctrine, laying out America's foreign policy for the next 80 years and warning European powers to stay out of the Americas. Monroe gets all of the credit, it's his name in the title, obviously, but it was largely the authorship of Secretary of State John Quincy Adams. Monroe basked in the credit of bringing Florida into the American fold, and with the relative peace in the face of unrest in the Spanish holdings throughout Central and South America. But he would be completely caught off guard with the outcry over General Andrew Jackson's conduct in Florida while serving as governor. One bright spot on the end of James Monroe's presidency was the return of the Marquis de Lafayette. President Monroe was unable to lodge the general, but he did make the executive mansion available for multiple informal parties, and he entertained him at a large, lavish dinner where Monroe broke protocol by having the general placed to his side rather than across the table. President Monroe wanted to entertain Lafayette at his Highland home, but he had to stay in the Capitol, and we'll talk about this with regards to his health and his wife. He arranged to have Lafayette visit him in his Oak Hill home in the summer of 1825, which we'll talk about in a bit. The Monroes were able to move back into the executive mansion in late 1817, but the East Room would still not be finished for another 10 years, and the North Portico would not be installed until 1824. Just to give you an idea of how unfinished the home was, and so when we think of them living in that mansion, just know that it's going to be a far cry from what we're familiar with. Where the Monroes put their imprint on the executive mansion or today's White House was on the decor, bringing a singularly French style that is still seen in fine furnishings like the Blue Room's chairs or the State Dining Room's gilt silver plateau. First Lady Elizabeth Monroe had caused quite a stir by ceasing Dolly Madison's custom, and one that had been shared by Martha Washington and Abigail Adams, of calling on dignitaries' wives. She left a time instead each week that people could come to the executive mansion, but this led to accusations that the infirm president's wife was imperious and altogether too European. Of course, much of this can be owed to the fact that Dolly Madison was just a very tough act to follow, And we'll talk about Elizabeth Monroe's health concerns that add insult to injury when it comes to her already kind of reserved way of handling things. Now, when we look at the end of James Monroe's presidency, like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, he will be all too eager to retire at the end of his last over 10 years of public service. But he will suffer from a rumor that he's trying to run for a third term and was possibly preparing the military to enforce his election. This was later traced back to John Randolph, who kind of was always a thorn in the side of first Jefferson, then Madison, and now Monroe. Historian Harry Ammon wrote that Monroe became short-tempered and impatient towards the end of his presidency, leading him to snap at one point at John Quincy Adams in an unusual flash of anger when Adams pressed Monroe to release correspondence that he thought might vindicate him in a nasty dispute over westward expansion. President Monroe felt that he might be perceived as him placing his thumb down on the scales in one way or the other, and that's something he tries to avoid at all costs, and so he'll erupt at Adams when he's called out. Monroe is going to take very personally any criticism about all of the different actions that he takes, but one that is going to really kind of linger is anybody saying that he has a favorite when it comes to his successor, when he tries as hard as possible to just stay out of the fray altogether. An example of this is, at one point, his friend, Governor James Barber of the famous Barbersville ruins that I've talked about before, wants James Monroe to come visit him, and Monroe will refuse out of a fear that his Secretary of the Treasury, William Crawford, might be there, and that people would think that he was in some way trying to tip his hand in that direction. In the same way, Secretary Adams is going to invite him to a ball for General Andrew Jackson to celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the Battle of New Orleans, but again, Monroe is going to be very concerned that people would just be watching him, and if he spent too much time with Adams or Jackson, that might tip his hand in one way. Unlike his two predecessors, Monroe largely deferred to the Congressional Caucus to choose his successor. Remember that Jefferson had all but promised that it would be James Madison, and in the same way, Madison really wanted James Monroe. But he's going to leave it up to this caucus system, and there's going to be a large dispute whether it will be Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, Secretary of the Treasury William Crawford, Secretary of War John C. Calhoun, the Speaker of the House Henry Clay, or General Andrew Jackson. He'll be largely sidelined as the Democratic-Republican instead will splinter in its support. Remember that at that time, the state's electoral votes were actual legislators and political figures, and so there wasn't the open polling that today, of course, we would assume when it comes to how those votes are allocated. Now, Monroe was personally targeted by dissatisfied partisans, even within his own cabinet, particularly by the Secretary of Treasury, William Crawford, who at one point had thought that in 1816, he was very young, just 44 years old, he is going to think he had a chance to kind of cut in line and take that spot. And when Jefferson and Madison are like, no, it really should be Monroe, Crawford's going to, of course, think, well, maybe in 8 years, it'll be my turn. But he holds it over James Monroe's head the entire time, always needling him like, I did you a favor. You're only here because I let you. And Monroe's like, okay, you know, kind of whatever. But now that 1824 has rolled around, it's going to be even more kind of critical. He thinks this debt is going to be repaid. Crawford shows up after the vote has all but been sealed, but he wants an additional favor from Monroe. And Monroe, of course, is going to be hesitant, and he demands the vocal support of Monroe on this action, saying, I wish you would not dilly-dally any longer and have a mind of your own, clearly alluding to Monroe sitting out any decision over his successor. Monroe asked if he came there only to treat him with disrespect, and Crawford then, out of nowhere, turns to threatening physical harm, raising his cane as if to hit President Monroe, saying, you infernal scoundrel, and there might have been an expletive. Monroe catches the cane and he orders Crawford to leave. Crawford kind of comes to his senses and says, it's just a misunderstanding, but they will never be in the executive mansion together again. President Monroe knew that Secretary Adams would be an apt successor and would largely keep his policies intact. John Quincy Adams is going to come to him after that closely contested election and even run by the cabinet selections to see if you have any kind of preference one way or the other. And at one point even read his inaugural address to James Monroe. On Inauguration Day, Monroe will ride with incoming President Adams to the Capitol and attended the ceremony in the House chamber, sitting beside the Supreme Court justices and in front of the Speaker's rostrum. After the ceremony, Monroe will accompany Adams back to Adams's home, where people came to call on the new president for about 2 hours, and then takes him back to the executive mansion, where there's a party for the outgoing President Monroe. Now, James Monroe's post-presidency will get off to a rocky start when his First Lady Elizabeth is unable to travel, requiring the Monroes to stay in the White House for an additional 3 weeks. When they finally depart on March the 23rd, an honorary escort will bring them to the city limits, and they leave for Oak Hill, their home in Aldie, a part of Loudoun County, in a home that Thomas Jefferson had designed and that we talked about in Season 2. Like his fellow Virginia presidents, however, Monroe will be in massive debt, some $75,000, which would be around $2 million today. Monroe will seek assistance from Congress, calling back to some of his pre-presidential service that had gone uncompensated, particularly when he was sent to Europe, and he was finally able to get some back pay, but this is going to be when he's already sold a lot of his properties. That General Lafayette was presented a large financial gift in payment for his service stung a bit for President Monroe, as well as Jefferson, it should be noted. Both men were too proud to beg, but they came awfully close. And in fact, the debate over Monroe's compensation will be hung up when the election of 1828 starts to play out. Monroe was in such financial straits that he is forced to sell his home, Highland, that we talked about in Season 2, that was near his friend Thomas Jefferson. Monroe at Oak Hill is determined to return to farming life, throwing himself into agriculture, focused primarily on raising sheep. He had a mill and a distillery built on that property. They also are now welcoming grandchildren, and they have their daughter Eliza and her family staying there and helping out, while also paying these visits to Maria, who's living in New York City. Monroe loved to spend his time in his library, like Adams, Jefferson, and Madison, and had collected some 3,000 books representing his various interests. Monroe, for a time, even set out to write his own book on political theory, and I'll read you the intense title. The People, the Sovereigns, being a comparison of the government of the United States with those of the republics which have existed before, with the cause of their decadence and fall. Quite a mouthful. He let his son-in-law read it, and he said bluntly, "I think your time could have been better employed," which is devastating. If my advisor had said that, we wouldn't be here, right? He told Monroe to focus on his own history, and Monroe takes it very well. I kind of wish students would take their criticism that well. And he starts working on his memoirs, and he'll work on those until he dies. Now, if you look at his memoirs, his attempt at an autobiography, it is in no way revealing. A lot of the information there was already found in existing records, and he doesn't dish in any way that would be compelling. He doesn't talk about any of the backstory or personal details that we would want, and instead it's a pretty kind of surface level account. James Monroe, as when he was president, tried to keep out of politics as a post-president, but he flirts at one point with his name being entered as a nominee for the Virginia governorship right after he left the executive mansion. He'll then decline and goes further and resists offers from President Adams to be sent to the Panama Congress in 1826. And then he made clear that when they're flirting with replacing John C. Calhoun, who's going to run with Andrew Jackson, Monroe says, "Don't look at me. I'm not going to be vice president. I am good and out." The Monroes did have a lot of visitors, not quite the volume of Washington or Jefferson, but Monroe is also very conscious of trying to keep any current political figures at arm's length. He is obsessed with this, and he does not want to be seen as meddling in the 1828 election whatsoever. He'll follow James Madison into the Virginia Constitutional Convention, representing Loudoun County, and then will be elected as its president in 1829 after both Madison and Chief Justice John Marshall will have declined their nomination. But he'll be forced to resign just 6 weeks into it as his health fails, and we'll talk about that in a second. Now, the highlight of Monroe's retirement, as we mentioned earlier, was having President Adams and General Lafayette visit Oak Hill in August of 1825, where they will bring with them this giant stream of people who want to just visit both the current and now former president and then Lafayette. It will be in the hottest months of the year. If you've ever been in Northern Virginia, you know how kind of unbearable this would have been. And they have to spend most of the day like indoors and lying completely still and trying to avoid doing anything that would be disruptive. And then at night they would, you know, get wild. At one point they will leave Oak Hill and go to nearby Leesburg, where Chief Justice John Marshall will show up to give a toast to both Lafayette and Monroe. Monroe was at first hesitant about his relationship with John Marshall. He'd been awfully critical of him and vice versa. But the two will then be reconciled, and you'll recall that they had been close friends when they were children, when they were young men and students. And so it's an interesting kind of end to their relationship as it comes full circle. As I said, the weather during this was unconscionable. And at one point, they're staying at Ludwell Lee's home there in Leesburg. And for whatever reason, President Adams and Monroe had to actually share the same bedchamber in the sweltering heat. And if that isn't a miniseries waiting to happen, like, please, I need more on this. In his farewell, Monroe is going to accompany Lafayette as he heads to Charlottesville for that big celebration we've been talking about in the previous two episodes, where the University of Virginia's rotunda will be used for this dinner featuring the three presidents. Lafayette will stay with Monroe at Highland, and then they will both go to nearby Monticello to visit with Jefferson. And this is the last time that Monroe will see his old friend and recognizes that it is that last time. They then go to James Madison's home at Montpelier, then on to Oak Hill, where Lafayette will then depart and take off for Washington and then home. This will be the last time the two men will see each other. Monroe follows Jefferson and Madison into becoming a regent at the University of Virginia. And remember that this was built on the grounds of his former home in Charlottesville, and there's a marker that says as much. Monroe would attend the Board of Regents meetings all the way through his move to New York City in 1830, and usually stayed with Madison for a few days at Montpelier since he had sold his home at Highland. Monroe and Madison do a very good job of recapturing their old friendship. You remember there had been kind of pause in their relationship for political reasons, but the two will spend a good deal of time laughing together. According to Harry Ammon, this is the youngest either man will really seem, where normally they're always very uptight, but with each other, they're able to just kind of let loose. A highlight will be in the summer of 1828, where with seemingly no backstory, the two just decide out of nowhere, we're going to go to Monticello. We want to tromp around the mountaintop in reminiscence of our dearly departed friend. When they're there, Madison will lose a shoe buckle. He's still wearing shoe buckles, and Monroe will quickly replace them. I know that just sounds kind of crazy, but it's a real you had to be there kind of story. Now, when it comes to his contribution to the University of Virginia, Monroe will only have this report where he wants a military officer there to instill the discipline and respect for those professors. Remember when we had talked about that horrible situation that brought Jefferson to tears? I don't know if you need a military officer, you know, making the students respect the professor. I do get behind that notion. I'm kidding. But Madison's like, nah, we're not doing that at University of Virginia. Now, Monroe also remains in very good contact with his former secretary and new president, John Quincy Adams, and even reached out to him when he lost the 1828 election. James had been approached to serve as an elector along with James Madison, but again, as always, he wants to remain neutral. Adams did not hold it against him. There's no ill will between them, and he'll even visit him in New York City on his way home to Boston. Monroe's efforts at neutrality will instead ring completely false to his successor, Andrew Jackson, who will never believe Monroe had not meddled in the 1824 election and even attacked James Monroe over reports going all the way back to his time as the governor of Florida. Monroe will constantly try to soothe over these accusations and will go to great lengths looking through his documents, but those resentments will never really fade away. Now, when it comes to Elizabeth Monroe, we had talked about how she had a kind of rough time as First Lady, especially trying to live up to the legacy of Dolly Madison. But Elizabeth has chronic pain, headaches, horrible headaches that are described very similar to the conditions of migraines, and then has rheumatism, which we've talked about as being this inflammation all over. And you always read that her beauty kind of disguised the discomfort that she was clearly going through. By the end of her time in the executive mansion, she had to discontinue all of those great salons and dinners, and she was in bad shape to the point that she would fall out of nowhere. James hoped that their time together in the post-presidency would be good for both of them, but her health will take a horrible turn if it could get worse. In 1826, they're having a dinner party, and Elizabeth will excuse herself, and they just hear a loud crash, and when they go up there, she had fallen in a fireplace, again out of nowhere, had kind of come to, and was able to kind of pull herself from that, but she will have all sorts of bruises and burns, and it will take some time for her to recover. The doctor who attends to her tells Eliza, their daughter, that Elizabeth was suffering from epilepsy, but Elizabeth made her daughter swear never to tell James. She will rally to take care of James when he takes a spill of his own. She even has to take dictation for him when he breaks his wrist. She's writing all his letters for him. And she will make these one big trip to New York City, mainly to be with her grandchildren and her daughter. And if you're a grandparent, I know my parents, that's all I think about. And so you could probably relate to that. The family is dealt a double blow when George Hay, the son-in-law who had come to live at Oak Hill, is going to fall ill and die. Eliza, their daughter, is going to then go to retrieve his body and then is told, you need to get home because your mother is also dying. James had been so worried about his wife's condition that he wrote to not just the daughter who was going to find her husband's body, but the other daughter from New York City to say, like, you need to get, I need somebody here with me. Elizabeth will die on September 23rd, 1830, as I said, just 2 days after her son-in-law, and James will fall to his knees at her bedside, sobbing uncontrollably. Elizabeth will be buried at Oak Hill, and they're constructing the vault. They have to delay the funeral so that they can build this vault, and they make it large enough to house two coffins. As they put her in it, James becomes completely irrational and is yelling that he will not leave her side and that they should just bury him in there with her. When the daughters finally get him to go inside, he goes through the house in a terror and starts to locate any papers of hers, anything that she's ever signed or wrote, and burns all of it. So we have almost no record of Elizabeth Monroe. This, of course, is going to set off huge alarm bells with the daughters, where they're like, he cannot be on his own. And not only that, he's not able to afford to stay on his own. And so he will move to be with his daughter Maria and Samuel Gouverneur, the New York State Postmaster in New York City. He wrote to a friend, quote, we have both suffered the most afflicting calamity that can befall us in life, and which, if time may alleviate it, it cannot efface. After having lived with the partner of your life so long together and afforded to each other's comforts, which no other person on earth could do as both of us have done, to have her snatched from us is an affliction which none but those who feel it can justly estimate. So he's in a bad way. The Gouverneurs had a two-story home on Prince and Lafayette Street and made room for the former president. At first, Monroe is going to try to be just any other citizen in New York City, even trying to do the household shopping, but he will be recognized and clearly, you know, he is going to have been well-renowned. His final public appearance will be in celebrating the overthrow of Charles X at Tammany Hall in 1830, and he still wrote to his dear friend Madison as often as he could. Monroe writes about hoping to use the proceeds from selling Oak Hill, the second home, to buy a house in New York City so that he could alleviate the strain that he's placing on his daughter, and he talked about making one final trip, likely to visit his wife's grave. Most of the time is spent, however, in a small bedroom at their home trying to recover from this awful cough, and then, of course, his broken heart. Now, James Monroe had been in mostly solid health throughout his adulthood, though he had contracted malaria as a youth and then had a bullet in his shoulder from the Battle of Trenton for the rest of his life. In 1815, out of nowhere, he has this long illness. We still don't know the exact details of it, but he is bedridden for a few weeks, and it is what causes him to give up being Secretary of War, though he'll remain a Secretary of State. He has a recurrence of malaria in 1818, which will also cause him to be temporarily bedridden. And then he'll try to retreat to Highland in the summer of 1823, but it has to be delayed because he's overcome by what they describe as violent convulsions, so quick and painful that he will think he's dying. Secretary Adams will write that Monroe had to, quote, lay upwards of 2 hours at a time in a state of insensibility, which sounds pretty awful to me. Friends and colleagues both tell him how exhausted he looked in 1825, which never feels good, you know, when you're being told that by other people, and that the office had aged him, which it does to most of the presidents, and he may have never fully recovered when he has a stroke in August of 1825. Still, he'll try to go horseback riding nearly every day, but will fall from his horse in 1829, and this is what injures his wrist, leaving him unable to write for a time, and his wife will take over those duties. For his wife's death, his health will be somewhat improved, and he would go for regular rides and walks. But then once his wife is dead and he has to move to New York City, a lot of those outdoor pursuits are just completely ended. Towards the end, he developed a chronic lung illness with a persistent cough and what may have been tuberculosis. And a doctor will tell him, you need to go to a tuberculosis hospital. Instead, he will sit in a room in complete darkness for quite some time. Near the end, he almost never leaves that room. President Adams will come to visit him in April of 1831 and wrote that he did not believe that Monroe would ever leave that room again. The cough was making it impossible for Monroe to fully rest, and he was getting weaker by the day. Adams is going to cut his trip short because he recognizes that every time that Monroe is trying to talk to him, he's expending so much energy, and so sadly, he will say goodbye. And as the 4th of July, 1831 approached, and he was somewhat lost after his wife had passed away, he thought of his old friend James Madison and was sending notice that he was resigning his post on the Board of Regents. And this is the correspondence we talked about the last episode about how the greatest pain was in knowing that he would never see James Madison again. Madison wrote back very similar sentiments, saying that he hoped that Monroe would come to visit him if he came back for one last trip to Oak Hill, but Monroe will never respond to that. His last recorded words were these sentiments to his friend Madison. On July the 4th, 1831, 5 years to the day after John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had died, James Monroe will die of heart failure at 73 years old in his daughter's home. General Winfield Scott, old Fessin' Feathers, is going to be beside him and actually close his eyes. Monroe was placed in a mahogany coffin with a silver plate reading, James Monroe of Virginia, died 4th of July, 1831, age 74 years. Monroe had a very dramatic New York City funeral, the largest at the time ever in New York City, with an elaborate hearse and four black horses and an honor guard leading from the governor home to City Hall, where he's placed on a platform draped in black. Eulogies will be presented before departing for a funeral at St. Paul's Episcopal, very near the same church that he and Elizabeth had been married in 45 years before. There were thousands of mourners lining Broadway, leading to the Governor Vault in Marble Cemetery, what's known as New York City Marble Cemetery, and cannons will be set off from the Battery for every year of Monroe's life. Like the previous three presidents, Monroe's death will be met with a day of mourning in most cities, and there will be eulogies and memorial resolutions to be read. President Jackson will order all military posts to set a day aside to honor Monroe by firing guns from noon until sunset, which seems like complete overkill, but, you know, they go kind of crazy this time. And in his will, Monroe will leave his estate to his two daughters. And like our previous two episodes, that is going to also be a lot of debt. When it comes to the gravesite, James Monroe, as I said, will be laid to rest in Marble Cemetery on 2nd Street. In the Governor family vault. He did not even get his own tombstone for the time that he is there, sharing with a man named Robert Tillotson. The cemetery and gravesite will fall into great disrepair, and the New York Times will report on its neglect in 1856. As we are approaching the centennial of his birth, there will be two competing movements over the course of the next year. One will be from Virginia expats in New York City who want to put a new monument over where Monroe had been buried, and the other will be trying to bring him back to Virginia. The growing sectional tensions between the North and the South will add to that debate, and Virginians will say, we want a Virginia president buried on Virginia soil. Henry Wise, the governor of Virginia, will take this effort very seriously and push for the removal of Monroe. In April 1858, the state of Virginia will authorize Monroe's body to be moved to Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond, which at that time is just getting started. On July the 2nd, 1858, Monroe will be taken from the Marble Cemetery vault and placed in a new coffin. The Monroe family had wanted a very small private transfer of Monroe back to Virginia, but the city of New York wants to demonstrate that they still love James Monroe, they're trying to do right by him, and so they have a much larger affair. There will be a procession to bring Monroe back down Broadway to City Hall, where there will be another public viewing of this new coffin with 10,000 people at least who will there are reports, go into a scene of revelry among those who had been conducting the honor guard after hours. Thousands will go to see Monroe loaded onto the Jamestown, this boat that will take him down to Richmond. But the Jamestown will actually stop in Washington so President Buchanan can pay his respects. And that's a lot for a president who's been dead at this point for over 20 years. Virginia's governor and Richmond's mayor will welcome the recovery of Monroe's coffin in a very elaborate ceremony, with Governor Wise delivering a speech at Hollywood Cemetery saying, "New York gave to him a hospitable grave. Virginia respectfully allowed his ashes to lie lone enough to consecrate her sister's soil, and now has dutifully taken them to be earth to her earth and ashes to her ashes at home in the land of his cradle." Very effusive language there. It was one of the last nice gestures, of course, between those two states for quite some time. Monroe will then be deposited in a brick and granite vault, and Governor Wise will reportedly be so overjoyed by this that he says he wants to add to that president circle in Hollywood Cemetery by then claiming Presidents Washington, Jefferson, and Madison, who you'll remember were all buried on their own properties and whose families at that moment are struggling to try to maintain the properties and the grave sites. An alderman from New York who had accompanied Monroe's body hears Governor Wise say this, and he says, "Go ahead, Governor, you go fetch him." You think this is easy? And so I thought that was kind of funny. Monroe will be buried in a spot in the cemetery with an 8x4 Virginia marble block with an inscription that reads, "James Monroe, born in Westmoreland County, 28 April 1758, died in the city of New York, 4 July 1831. By order of the General Assembly, his remains were removed to the cemetery on 5 July 1858 as an evidence of the affection of Virginia for her good and honored son." On the other side, it will read, "James Monroe, Governor of Virginia, 1799 to 1802 and 1811, President of the United States, 1817 to 1825. That plaque, the one that lists his governor and presidential service, will have been stolen and never recovered. The next year, they will install a distinctive 12-foot tall iron structure that'll be placed over the tomb. Now, when you look at it, it was meant to evoke the iron latticework of European cathedrals, and each side is distinctive, but it's always, almost always referred to as a birdcage. And please go on the website and confirm it's a birdcage. It looks like a birdcage. The cage will be painted black for several years. The National Register of Historic Places called it, quote, "a flamboyant Gothic revival style." So that's the way they write it. And it definitely will be distinct in all presidential grave sites. I actually think it's kind of pretty. Now, Elizabeth, you might be wondering, she's still at Oak Hill until 1903. When she's finally removed to be buried beside James. And lest you think that they're going to make room for her underneath that giant birdcage, no, she is beside him with a distinctly smaller and less noticeable marker. And I have on my page, one of the times I visited, they had cut the grass and it was completely covered in grass. I had to kind of remove it. The gravesite for James and Elizabeth will fall into real disrepair, with a Utah Journal article pointing out how rusted and drab the site appeared. In 1923, to celebrate the anniversary of the Monroe Doctrine, there's an elaborate ceremony with William Jennings Bryan and Virginia's Governor Lee Trinkle holding court, and this will lead to them kind of doing right by it and trying to make the site much more attractive. This is one of the few presidential gravesites that will be made a National Historic Landmark, being given that distinction in 1971. It was finally renovated in 2015 and actually repainted. And I'll read you from the article. "The cast iron canopy over Monroe's tomb had undergone an extensive $900,000 restoration, making it completely dismantled, with parts that were missing or badly damaged having to be recast before being painted and reassembled." And I'll include images from that on the website. Now, when it comes to what you'll find when you go to visit, this is at Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond at the address 412 Cherry Street. Once you get there, there are maps as well as a painted path that you can follow to what's called the President Circle. And once you get there, you can find the gravesite, not just of James Monroe, which you could see from a good distance away, but then John Tyler, the 10th president, is also right next to it. And in fact, you can get photos of both gravesites, which I do have also on the website. Now, the thing to keep in mind is it is a cemetery, and so it does get locked at, I believe it's 5 o'clock p.m., And I did have a trip that I was too late, and the gates are locked right at 5 and then opened at 9 in the morning. And so you will want to make sure to go between those hours. And again, I always recommend checking the website in case there's some big event or something else happening, just to make sure you're able to go inside. Now, once you do, as I said, you can follow the path and make it. It is a beautiful cemetery overlooking the James River. It's very tranquil, very beautiful. This is also the cemetery that houses some Confederates and also has Jefferson Davis, who for quite some time was probably the bigger draw between the two American presidents and then this Confederate president. And so you can do with that information what you wish. Now, my visits to the cemetery started in 2015, really kind of inspired by earlier that summer when I had first gone to Zachary Taylor's gravesite, and I was making another trip. In this case, I was going down to my friend Will's wedding in Georgia. And on the way, I was starting in Washington, D.C., and then winding my way to Atlanta. I was really interested in just going to Richmond, and this was when a lot of the monuments were still up on Monument Avenue. But it was right after the shooting at Emmanuel Baptist in Charleston. And so going to the White House of the Confederacy or even the Virginia State House, it was just a kind of eerie feeling. But I did go to the cemetery. It was the one time that I was able to see it in that distinctive black paint. And so you will see those images on my website. My next time going to visit was in the summer of 2021. And I'm not really sure why I would have gone by and just not stopped in. But like in 2017, I was very close by in going to the Berkeley Mansion and that kind of thing, but I did not go to the cemetery. And so I didn't even know that it had been repainted. And I remember going back that summer of 2021 and being really caught off guard, where like it looked gorgeous in the sunlight. And you'll see those images. I think it really does make all of the details of the ironwork really kind of pop off a bit more. And so definitely recommend checking out the website for those images. I went back in the summer of 2022, and this time I had time to kill. It was the morning that I was going to Tuckahoe, where Thomas Jefferson was raised. And so I had, again, like just a little bit of time that I was like, well, I'll just stop by and just get my photos in front of that. That was the time that I did want photos with the gravesite. And so that was one of the things that I was really looking for on that trip. And then the summer of 2023, I went back through, this time with my friend Stephanie. I really wanted her to be able to see this gravesite with the two different presidents and be able to kind of take in the beautiful architecture of the site. So that was one of the big draws of revisiting it. And it's a good testament to, you might think you remember a certain site or might think you know what you're getting. And I was definitely caught off guard when I had revisited it after 6 years. So definitely a good reason for you to always think about maybe going back to revisit places that you've seen. Now, in terms of James Monroe's legacy, he does have a lot of different counties and cities named after him. I counted 20 different American cities. And then of the counties, it's 17 counties. But townships, I found in the state of Ohio alone, there's 20 different townships in the various counties, giving you a good sense of just how prominent he would have been, especially in the Midwest at a time when he's either president or had just died or whatever the case might have been. Like, he has a lot of places named after him. He's the only American president that has a foreign capital named after him. Monrovia in Liberia, right, was named for James Monroe. Now, he, like James Madison, does not have too many different monuments dedicated exclusively to James Monroe. He has a mountain that's named after him and other tributes throughout the country, but nothing on the level of a Washington or Jefferson. And when it came to statues that I've seen of him, the one that most comes to mind is one at his former property at Highland. Now, I definitely recommend visiting Highland, where they do a really good job of kind of contextualizing his life and certainly his legacy. I also recommend going to visit his office, now called a museum, in Fredericksburg, as well as his restored birthplace in Colonial Beach. So there are all sorts of different places where you can get in touch with James Monroe's legacy. Like I said, he's not going to be treated on the same level of a Jefferson or Washington or even a Madison. Just him being a kind of witness to all of these historical events is really kind of prominent and something really kind of cool. Where his tomb, I think, is so distinctive and really speaks to the idea that he is this kind of bridge between different eras. He has this kind of European flavor, even if he is as American as apple pie. And I think he's always treated as a kind of third wheel, right? Or a fourth wheel in some cases, where he's never given the same kind of respect. In almost every book that I read, they were saying how he was just not as smart, just not as intelligent as the other three Virginia presidents who came before him. Again, I think, like, for me, what really comes to mind is him being like Chance Gardner and being there, where he is at every major event that you could think of. I wanted to read to you from John Quincy Adams's eulogy for James Monroe. And keep in mind that he had a front row seat to James Monroe's exploits, where he talks about James Monroe's service all the way dating back to the Battle at Trenton, serving beside George Washington, trying to answer the call, maybe not being on the same level as Madison or Jefferson. But Virginia's a pretty stacked state when it comes to, you know, who's going to be representative, who's going to be, you know, serving as a senator. And he did serve whatever was asked of him, right? Going abroad, being one of the initial senators. And then when Jefferson needs him, he's there. When Madison needs him, he's there. The way he ends it, I think, is really beautiful, where he spent a good deal of time really kind of justifying what the foreign policy of James Monroe had meant and how that was going to be an enduring legacy for him. But I loved how he ended it. Thus strengthening and consolidating the federative edifice of his country's union till he was entitled to say, like Augustus Caesar of his imperial city, that he had found her built of brick and left her constructed of marble. Like, when you think about him going to Washington, D.C. to become president and the city, you know, getting back on its feet after a devastating war. And then when he leaves Washington, it's through a lot of kind of political dissension. I'm sure it's not the way he wanted to leave it. But, you know, for want of somebody who's going to be more dynamic, I think Monroe is just going to always err maybe too much on cautiousness, but that doesn't mean that he wasn't trying to be as safe and thinking about the preservation and doing right by the job that he had sworn to uphold and then by the country that he clearly gave everything to. Thought that was a really nice way of ending our analysis of James Monroe. But definitely, if you get the chance and you're in Central Virginia, please go to Richmond and check out that cemetery and get to see the way that James Monroe is preserved. Now, if you're inclined to go and visit his former cemetery, just keep in mind that the New York City Marble Cemetery, again, remember there's two different cemeteries, maybe a block away from one another. And this is really on the 2nd Street, all the way down close to Soho. In fact, when I had gone to visit the gravesite just to go by the cemetery, it's closed to the public. And so there are days that they have open house that people are able to go in, usually during the summer. But I just wanted to go outside the gates. I parked at Katz's Deli. So if you're familiar where that is, you could walk there from Katz's Deli. But that's as close as you're able to get, again, unless you're able to get inside that cemetery. And you can look on the website and make sure you're able to be there. But to what I've been able to find, there is no marker for him. Remember, that was part of the problem, that they didn't have anything for him. And so that's one of the main reasons that they wanted to move him away. So there is no commemoration of him at that cemetery. In the same way, I haven't been able to find anything of the commemoration at Oak Hill. Remember, this is in private hands today. And so I'm not even able to see if there is a vault that is still remaining or what happened to that structure that had been built for Elizabeth and James and only housed Elizabeth. But that is something that I remain open to finding. First four episodes, we are able to go to the exact spot where the president has died, as all four of our first presidents had died in their own homes. And so on your tours, you are able to see the exact spot where that took place. James Monroe is our first president who the house has been completely destroyed. And so you are able to see the spot where it happened, where that house had been, but you're not able to go inside, and it's certainly not going to be anything like what it had been before. Today on Prince Street, at the corner of Prince and Lafayette, there are all sorts of different businesses. In the summer of 2023, I went by just to see what I could see of the site. There is no commemoration whatsoever. It's a complete storefront on the outside. Did take my picture in front of it. I made sure I was at the exact site, and I'll include a picture of that on the website. But if you're in New York City and thinking you're going to load up on Monroe sites, you know, certainly walking by the cemetery gates and being able to go in front of the spot where the house had been, that's as close as you're going to get.
at one point there had been a group dedicated to preserving the site of the Monroe home in Washington, in New York City, but they had a giant plaque out in front. You'll remember this from my season 2 episode on Monroe, but that is all completely gone. So go back and listen to season 2 if you want the particulars of that site, but I did want to make mention of this is where Monroe passed away, but again, there's nothing left of it today. Now with that, we will turn our attention in next episode to John Quincy Adams, who, like Adams, Jefferson, and Madison, will have a very long post-presidency. It's something I should have mentioned with poor James Monroe. You know, he leaves in 1825 and will have the second shortest post-presidency at that time. And then all the way to the present, it's still one of the shorter post-presidencies. So does not get that kind of long, distinguished time. His health is just going to be a complete nightmare. But the exact opposite when we come back next time with John Quincy Adams, who will be our only president to return to the House of Representatives and serve there for 18 years, right? And even die in the Capitol building, the only president to hold that distinction. So you will not want to miss John Quincy Adams in next episode. Remember to check out visitingthepresidents.com, where you can find previous episodes, the links to associated readings for the presidential sites, my photos from various trips, recommended readings, and so much more. You can also follow along on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for Visiting the Presidents. Also consider supporting Visiting the Presidents by writing a review or donating through PayPal. All season, I've been bringing you content from William D. Gregorio's Complete Book of U.S. Presidents, Louis Picone's The President is Dead, and I also highly recommend Brady Carlson's Dead Presidents. For James Monroe, I had three books that I was really focusing my content on, and I mentioned before Harry Ammon's James Monroe, The Quest for National Identity. There's also Harlow Giles Unger's The Last Founding Father, James Monroe and a Nation's Call to Greatness. And then, of course, Tim McGrath's voluminous James Monroe, A Life. And all of those come very highly recommended. And as I said, you will not want to miss the next episode as we revisit Quincy, Massachusetts and John Quincy Adams's tomb in his post-presidency. And with that, I look forward to seeing you out there again on the road as we continue to visit the presidents. See ya.